I'm Norma Townsend. I have been a part of this church since 1960. It was in the summer of 1960 that my husband and I found Westridge Hills Church at 55th Place and Lynn. We walked in that morning to this congregation ready for worship. There was just a special feeling in that room. They wanted to see people changed with the love of Christ. They were the church. And we felt such acceptance, such love, and that's where, you know, we began to grow in Christ. Marty was our pastor by this time. That's when the 12-step program was kind of introduced into our church, and new people started coming. We were reaching people that we never really thought about reaching, but they were coming, and there was excitement. There has been unity, there has been humility, there has been a sacrificial spirit among the people, and just a love for the Lord. It was His place, and we are just stewards of it.
Well, didn't you just love those pictures of me from 40 years ago? Because I look so much better now. They said, you need to preview this. I looked at it, I thought, oh no. You know, but anyway, these guys are geniuses that put all that together. Matthew 11:28, you've heard it before. It's one to memorize. Jesus said, come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. I'm sure if I were to ask, if you'd raise your hand, if you've ever been weary and carrying heavy burdens, most everybody, if we're honest, we'd all raise our hands. And now I want to know, how many people might you know that is weary or carrying heavy burdens? Are you praying for them? Are you looking for a way to possibly give them some hope and help carry and unload that heavy burden? We're going to start a new series today, and John Ortberg will be with us next Sunday with a brand new book out called Steps. And it's going to be a great week around here and the next 5-6 weeks, however long it takes, as we go to an old list that was made probably 100 years ago called the 12 Steps. I'll say more about that in just a moment. Sam Shoemaker became the pastor of Calvary Church in New York City in 1925. When Sam became the pastor of the church, he walked the city blocks around the church to see what the community was like. Unfortunately, the previous leadership maybe had some financial troubles for a season, and there were two buildings they had. One was a chapel, and one was called the Lodging House, where people could stay if they were in a crisis or in need, or maybe a pastor was coming through and would stay there and speak or something. But both of those buildings, the chapel and the lodging house, are not being used. As Shoemaker walked the blocks around him there in New York City, he noticed there was an area called the Gas House District, an area of immense poverty. Most of the men didn't have jobs. Many of the men stayed drunk most of the time. And Sam wrote in his diary that afternoon these words: it has always seemed to me that a vital church should be reaching not only the settled working people with homes and families, but also those without any place in society. The homeless, friendless, faithless derelicts who've lost everything. While we work with people of sufficient privilege to find their way into church, what is happening to those in the Gas House District? And God answered the prayer, and a traveling preacher had come in later that day. He'd never met him, but his name was Henry Hadley. He traveled to speak at churches around the country and beyond. And he came to Sam Shoemaker and said, I'm ready to settle down in a church. How can I help? So within a few days, Henry had been hired, and they immediately got to work on the lodging house and the chapel. 60 days later, the chapel and the lodging house were completed, cleaned up, and ready to use again, ready to now serve the community. A few weeks later, they were having services in their restored chapel. They sang a few hymns, and Reverend Hadley shared the story of how he found Jesus Christ. As Hadley finished talking, a man in the audience jumped to his feet and said, "I just want to give thanks for 7 days without drinking." 10 years later, from 1925 to 1935, they kept track of attendance. Every pastor keeps track of attendance. Some pastors make them look a little better than they really are. Not me. 10 years later, they let someone know how many men and women, mainly men at that time, as a men's ministry, had come to the church, had come to the mission there in the chapel through the week. 210,403. 39,143 came forward for prayer in that 10 years. 147,896 people were given beds, and 228,658 were fed. One of those men, one of those 210,403,000 was a man who showed up drunk. His name is Bill W. And over time, he sobered up, got his life back on solid ground following Jesus. And Bill and Sam began talking about a way to help other people stop drinking too. Bill W. and Sam Shoemaker and another friend and pastor, Bardwell Smith, along with a few others, embraced the idea that people need a place to be honest in their trials and troubles and thus get well. Bill W. would later sober up and write down 12 steps that he used, 12 things that he did during that time that helped him get sober, thinking, "I'll have these in print now for I can give them to other people who are trying to stop drinking." Now, they've gone through many iterations. It wasn't copyrighted, and so there's been a lot of people take 12 steps and turn them into something it was never intended to be. But they have, it's free country, and there's no copyright, so people can use them as they wish. But Bill W. meant every word he said when he wrote these down. Bill would get sober. He would help in the church. And then he would actually write a foreword. Bardwell Smith would write the foreword to Sam's book titled, "I Stand by the Door." And this is just further clarity of why I love this Shoemaker guy. To evaluate him by what he was not to miss, let me start over with that. This is from Bardwell, and he said this: "To evaluate him, Sam, by what he was not is to miss the extraordinariness of what he was. To see him in the light of what he struggled against may be closer to the point. With clear objectives in mind, Sam Shoemaker was a life filled with struggle with himself, with various roadblocks to faith, with self-righteousness in any form, with the church's constant tendency to..." Now, listen to this sentence. Shoemaker's life was one filled with struggle himself, but with various roadblocks to faith, with self-righteousness in any form, with the church's constant tendency to honor the vessels and ignore the treasure. Churches still do that today. We honor the vessel, but we ignore the treasure that God put in them. This story of Sam Shoemaker continues all the way for me to 1985. My parents had gone through a divorce, and Dad was moving to California. He came through Oklahoma City on his way west, and he had one box too many packed into his Toyota. That everything Dad owned in that moment was in that Toyota. And there were two boxes in the front seat, or maybe one or two. I know there's one, but I think there was two. But he had to get rid of one to be able to make the drive, be able to see out of the windows and all that as he drove to California. Dad's driving was terrible when all the windows were good. And So now I can say this now because since he's with Jesus, but we wouldn't let our kids, his grandkids, ride with him in his car. It was, you know, he just, whew. You remember, this is just a side note, which, you know, with a little ADD, you go bing, 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 bing. Remember, have you seen a movie where on the Pacific Coast Highway down in Newport Beach, there used to be this famous sign that said, "Welcome to Laguna Beach." It's in movies. My dad fell asleep on Pacific Coast Highway and took out the famous sign. Demolished it. So, I rest my case. No, kids, you can't ride with Grandpa. You can't get in that car. Mom and Dad had been through a pretty tough divorce. Dad was a pastor of a fairly large church in Ohio, and the news got out quick. And he was coming through Oklahoma City with all these, his clothes and books and all kinds of things. So it was a perfect time because he left one of his boxes of books with me, and I needed all the books I could get because I had a music business degree and I did a degree also in religious studies. But I'd never planned to be a pastor, nor was I qualified to be one. And frankly, I'm still not. I'm just living proof that God will use you if you just let him, you know, get out of his way and do what he's telling you to do. So I'm, yeah. And I still days I go, what were you thinking? So I was asked to be the pastor of the church. My moment of desperation for sure. So I had one box of books and the bookshelves that went from floor to ceiling, but I had one shelf of books. They were my dad's. And as I opened that box of books, laying on top, with the front of it up, was this book, I Stand by the Door. I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard of Sam Shoemaker. I thought, well, this looks interesting. So I took it home and thumbed through it and read the story, and it was pretty phenomenal to read. I moved into this small pastor study and had my books, and this one was one, though, that for whatever reason, laying right on top, Dad's name is in it. I thought, I want to see what that's about. I read it. Couldn't stop reading it, couldn't put it down. The Life of Sam Shoemaker. 2 years later, a friend of mine and I were standing in the church foyer down at Belle Isle, and someone came up to me in the foyer there between services and said, "Hey, Marty, how are your folks doing?" I said, "They're fine," which was a lie. And the motive was just, I'm in a hurry, I've got to get back into the sanctuary, let's talk later. But I didn't say, let's talk later, I said, "Oh, they're fine." And a gentleman who'd been in our church a while overheard me. And he walked over to me and he says, "You just told a lie." I said, "Well, happy Lord's Day to you too, you know." He says, "I'm going to pick you up tomorrow at noon, a little before noon." Okay, we'll have lunch. He picked me up on Monday, a little before noon. We drove over to Western. Some of you have heard this. I've said this before, so I know I'm repeating it on purpose, all right? Every few years, I want to repeat this. It's not that I've forgotten. I've already said it, you know, a year ago, all right? So some of you got a lot of new people in this church, so you all better really listen because you're the reason I'm doing this. So he takes me over in Weston, and we pull up into the parking lot of a building that looks like it's absolutely falling apart. It's this nondescript brick building with no windows in it. So I knew it wasn't a restaurant. And at one point I'm going, is this a drug deal or are we, well, what is this? We walk into this large room and there are men sitting in this huge circle, two rows maybe of men. And as my friend said, this is an AA meeting. I said, "Well, why would I go to this? I don't drink." And he said, "No, but you're crazy. And I want you to experience this. And I will just tell you, it changed my life. It changed our ministry. And I remember the first time after I'd spent some time getting to know and get acquainted with 12 Steps, and then Sam Shoemaker's book, I did a series on the 12 Steps. No, at the time, that wasn't being done much. Rick Warren was doing it, and he would always send all his outlines and tapes, and we could use them, didn't even have to give him credit. And I took him up on that. And it just changed us. And our church almost doubled in size in those 12 weeks. I had one gentleman come in, and he said, "I didn't know what the beep you were thinking about doing 12 steps in a church." But he smiled and he goes, "I'll be back next week." God did some pretty amazing things in that time. And that invite to an AA meeting was phenomenal. I didn't go back to one, probably should at this point, but it changed my life. And in Dad's book that he had in this box, when I opened it up, and again, many of you have heard this too, but I do it once or twice a year. This is what it said. Here I am, a young pastor, thinking, what am I supposed to do now? We had more people leaving than coming, you know. "I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It's the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And this is a good one. And all that so many people ever find is a wall where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door." And he's talking men and people, he's just using this word. "The door to God. It's the most tremendous thing in the world for people to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing any of us can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to their own touch. People die outside that door. Starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter. Die for what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they've not found it, and nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find Jesus. So I stand by the door. Go on in, great saints, go all the way in, go down to the cavernous cellars and way into the spacious attics. It's a vast, roomy house, this house where God is. Go into the deepest of hidden casements, of withdrawal, of silence, of sainthood. Some must inhabit those inner rooms and know the depths and heights of God. And they call outside to the rest of us how wonderful it is. And sometimes I take a deeper look in the church. Some venture in a little farther, but my place seems closer to the opening, so I stand by the door. And this is another reason why I stand there. Some people get partway in and become afraid, lest God and the zeal of his house devour them. For God is so very great and asks all of us. And these people feel a cosmic claustrophobia, and they want to get out. Let me out, they cry. And sometimes the people inside the church, and sometimes the people inside somebody, those people that are inside, terrify us. So Sam says, "I stand by the door to tell them how much better life is inside the family of God." Somebody must watch for those who've entered the door, but I like to, and then want to run away. So for them too, I stand by the door. I admire people who go way in. Now this is just, if you remember nothing else, remember this one, because this is the disease in many churches. I admire people who go way in. I just wish those who go in would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who've not even found the door yet. Or the people that want to run away from God. You can go in too deeply into the church and stay too long and forget the people outside the door. But for me, I'll take my old accustomed place near enough to God to hear him and know he's there, but not so far from men as not hear them. And remember, they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them, millions of them, but more important for me, one of them, two of them, 10 of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I'd rather be a doorkeeper, so I stand by the door. Now imagine, probably my first week or two as a pastor, and I thought, well, that'll preach. So now you know why that book is pretty special to me, particularly that statement on standing by the door. There are 12 step, or not 12 step, there are meetings and the gatherings, and that church would continue each night of the week for a season. And there were, during the end of one of those was a gentleman stood up, loudly just said, I'm just glad. I'm glad I've been sober for, or I haven't had anything to drink for 7 days. We heard that. But there was another one in there. Another man who showed up drunk, and his name was Bill W. Bill W. was tired of letting alcohol destroy his marriage, his family, his friendships. So when he came to Christ there at Calvary Church, he made a list of things that helped him get sober and stay sober. So again, they've taken those lists and gone a lot of places with him that he would probably not have wanted to happen at all. He didn't fully understand God, but he wanted to learn more about him. So he turns his life over to God. He did not say he turned his life over to God as he created him or made him out to be on his terms. He just said, as little as I know and understand about God, I know enough and I've heard enough to know there's more to learn. I know that he loves me and wants to help me overcome things in my life that were destroying me. And he said he did not say he wanted to turn his life over to God he created or God that fit his thinking. He just was tired of being drunk all the time. So he wrote these down because this is what helped me get sober, and I'll help. Maybe my list will help somebody else. To those of you who claim to know God and follow Jesus, could you possibly make room in your life? And many of you, I'm sure, are already doing this. If you're not, this is a season right now in this church in the next 6 weeks or so. Could you be one of those who you could reach to and help them have a chance to know Jesus? Help them have a chance to turn life around. Going back and forth through Colorado, most every year, summer typically, once or twice, and I picked up a newspaper many years ago, and the Denver Zoo had a new polar bear to come into their zoo. The bear got there before they had the bear's quarters, his new quarters, fixed. So he was in this large cage while they finished up where he was going to live permanently at the Denver Zoo. And they noticed that week or two in that he would get up and just kind of, well, that's all he could do, you know, if he didn't have that far to go, but he'd go 4 or 5 steps that way, turn around, come back and go 4 or 5 steps over here. Just pacing. Maybe you know where this is headed. So that his turf where they were gonna let him live, his special place in the zoo, it was ready for him. And they let him out of the cage and into this new, beautiful area full of plenty of room and running water and all the things that a polar bear should have. And you know probably where I'm going with this. He kept walking 4 or 5 steps over. He'd come back and go 4 or 5 steps that way. He just couldn't make the transition from the cage to this beautiful home in the zoo. And probably I'm not the only one in the room that occasionally have settled for a little less than God's best, than what God wants to give us. Hear these words. Confess your sins to one another, James 5:16. Those of you who are strong, bear with the failings of the weak, Romans 15:1. Here's one. Love one another, because that will prove to the world that we follow him. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, Ephesians 5:21. Ephesians 4:22, be kind to one another, forgiving one another, just as God through Christ has forgiven you. Oh, look at this one, Colossians 3:13. Make allowance for each other's faults. Make allowance. Romans 15:7. Encourage each other and build each other up. Encourage each other and build each other up. Simple steps, just a few verses. There's hundreds more, if not thousands. But to help us wake up and realize the life we've been given through Jesus Christ, and we know it's a life we'd love everybody to have. And I would like to hope and pray that in this year of 2025, we'll continue to reach people who are tired of the cage, and they're ready to become whatever and whoever God created them to be. I've already said too, earlier this year, or last year, late last year, about what, in a span of 2 weeks, we had over 100, I think it was like over 106 people graduate from the STEP studies and Celebrate Recovery. And that's why we do it. In John 5:15, I'll close with this. John 5, verses 1 through 15, there's a story of a paralyzed man who'd been laying by the pool of Bethesda. In other versions say Bethsaida. John 5, 1:15 says, Jesus is there talking to this man who cannot walk. He's been laying by the pool, and the belief was when the water would stir, if you got into the water, you'd be healed. And he was telling Jesus, well, every time the water stirs, everybody gets in ahead of me and nobody will help me get into the water. So I'm laying here waiting for my chance. And, you know, as you're reading it years ago when I was reading through this, you would think that Jesus is going to say, oh, let me help you. I will help you get in that water. That's not what he said. He said one of the best questions. It's for all of us. Jesus said to this gentleman, paralyzed, had never walked. Jesus said, do you want to get well? Do you want to get well? At first you think, well, Lord, why do you think he's laying there? Oh, no. But in other words, do you want to get well? Do you really want a life? Because the minute you can walk, you're going to be responsible for things you've never been responsible for. The minute you can walk, there's no more laying there every day of the week. You're going to be a new person. Now, this wasn't said, but it can be, I think, assumed in that conversation. Why did Jesus say that? Do you want to be well? Or do you want to stay stuck? Do you want to stay paralyzed? It's a great question for all of us, and we all need to answer it. Do you want to be well? And you're not going to get well until you can answer that question honestly. Because for this gentleman by the pool, getting well for him was going to be a radical change in his life. Yeah, it'd be awesome to walk, but boy, the responsibilities that come with it. So we will be posing this question to whoever should come to our church, visit our church in the next several weeks, and ask, do you really want to get well? Are you really sick and tired of being sick and tired? If that's the case, I would ask you to start praying for someone who might walk in the door and they really do want a different life. The one they've tried has failed them. And they've learned it the hard way, as most of us probably do. But somebody told me about Jesus somewhere in my life. And somebody probably told most of you about Jesus somewhere in your life. I'm just going to propose that we all take part in that experience and in this opportunity to tell somebody about Jesus. Because we're all beggars looking for bread. And let's become people who will catch those who come through the door wondering what they've done, wondering if they'll be judged, wondering if they'll be loved, wondering if they'll be accepted. And let's pray about that as we continue the series. We're going to share communion together in just a moment. So the ushers will come forward, and if you want to go ahead, ushers, and come forward, and we'll serve the bread and the cup. This is a great time for us to remember the sacrifice. That's why Jesus did this with the disciples. The bread demonstrating his body broken for us, the cup demonstrating the blood of Christ. So listen to the words of the song, and as it's served, we'll take it together once everybody has been served.